I never forget the first moment when I walked in through the cinema. I was hooked from there on.
Hello and welcome to the Scanon Podcast, your weekly look at the world of film, Irish and international. I'm Darren, and joining me are...
Roman.
Graham.
So this week we're going to talk about the usual. We're going to look at the week in film news, Irish international. We're also going to take a look at the top 10 and the new releases. But we're going to start with what we normally start with. So, Ronan, what have you watched this week?
I had a really good week, actually. Caught a lot of very, very good things in the cinema and at home. It was unusual. One of the best surprises for me was the IFI Mystery Matinee I went along to last weekend. And it is, you know, it's usually quite a good treat. They'll throw up, whether it was Mom and Dad a couple of months back, or other
Citizen
kind of...
Citizen Jane, I think, leading up to the abortion referendum, if I recall correctly. Well.
Citizen Ruth.
Citizen Ruth.
Yeah, they always throw up something. It's kind of a fascinating choice, whether it's, you know, an older choice or a preview. This time, you try to guess as much as you can, but normally they'll throw up something from the past. They don't do previews that often.
Yeah.
So I was trying to figure out what could it be, and... As soon as the opening notes came along, I, you know, gave up a little cheer. It was Robert Altman's A Long Goodbye, which I have not previously seen in the cinema.
Elliot Gould
as Philip Marlowe, Raymond Chandler adaptation, 1973, and one of my favorite films ever, I think, at this point.
Having not seen it before?
No, I've seen it.
Oh, sorry.
I've seen it a few times. big fan of the whole film noir, private detective genre, and a huge fan of, you know, Humphrey Bogart taking up this role, as he did really memorably in The Big Sleep. Gould in the 70s is a totally different twist on it. Altman has such a good time with it. It's this really, it's actually written by Lee Brackett, who wrote The Big Sleep. She had a hand in the script originally. Anyway. Yeah, so she's both her and Altman are really, really aware of this genre, and you know, you get it with Altman that he plays around with genres all the time.
So you have that sort of separation in time.
Yeah, 31 year difference.
Almost like Chinatown and the Two Jakes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Except obviously one imagined this was a great deal better.
Yeah, you could say that. Better than Chinatown, in fact. Chinatown is always held up as like the prototypical neo-noir. For me, it's absolutely The Long Goodbye because it really, really consciously plays with the tropes of the, you know, by then gone genre. I just fell in love with it the first time I saw it a couple of years back, have revisited it over the years since, and to get a chance to see it on the big screen with a crowd of mostly people who hadn't seen it, judging by the sounds. Gould is just fantastic. He does this amazing thing of that sort of smarmy voiceover style that's a core part of the film noir character. He does it as this weird mumbling to himself. You can barely hear him half the time. It's not done in voiceover, so it sort of recontextualizes the character as this, you know, instead of his confidence, he's just a rambling madman, really, wandering through 1970s L.A., completely out of place.
You're transitioning from Dragnet to, what's a James Garner show?
Is this in his early 30s, late 20s?
Now, at this stage, he would have been in his 40s, probably.
Gould is.
Oh, is he in his 80s now?
Yeah, he must be. He would be early 80s.
The last thing I saw him in was...
Friends.
No, I think the last thing I saw him in was Ocean's 8.
He's still going strong.
Yeah, he's still going strong.
He really is.
As good as Gould.
It's got this amazing contrast between, you know, it constantly gives you what you don't expect of film noir and yet what you do expect. You know, it's satisfying the genre desires while completely inverting them, and it just plays with everything beautifully. Gould's performance is incredible. He's so funny and wisecracking, drawing on Bogart and all his predecessors, but doing something quite new with it. And it's this really fascinating sort of tract on the changing culture of America at the time in the early 70s, where the counterculture was sort of dying out. And there's this amazing sense. It really put me in mind, actually, of Invasion of the Body Snatchers, which we discussed
recently.
In the way it has this amazing thing of the sense that its characters are looking around at the world going, everything is completely different. When did that happen?
Yeah.
It's really great, and you know, at this point, not just my favorite neo-noir, probably my favorite noir.
Nice.
And absolutely my favorite Altman, which is high praise.
That's pretty high
extremely
praise.
Extremely high praise.
First thing I go with The Player as my own.
The Player is great. Player is absolutely terrific. Yeah, I've seen very few Altmans that I didn't adore.
Yeah.
And it went down really, really well with the crowd. You know, there were a bunch of people who, from the sound of it, had never experienced this before and just laughing hysterically through the whole thing. It was really, really good to see. As we're on theatrical experiences and revisits, I went to 2001 on 70mm.
Oh,
which
always good.
Yeah, always good. I've seen it three times theatrically now. First time was 35mm in a huge auditorium with, I think, 3,600 people, which was an experience of its own. Second time on DCP at the Opera House in Cork, which isn't an ideal venue for seeing films, frankly, but nice big screen. Both times, as is my wont, I sat quite close to the front.
Yeah.
This time, having spoken with the IFI's projectionist in advance about the, you know, the
the prime position.
Yeah, absolutely.
For the sound.
I want to make sure 70 mil.
Getting the full experience.
Yeah.
Is that actually a thing to talk to them about?
Where to be optimally positioned.
Cool. Especially when it comes into the sound itself, and you know, 70 mil has has the double tracks.
Because then you have to be positioned so it's
optimally
from. Now, of course, every seat in the cinema is great if you ask a ticket vendor. But
sure. But
good seats.
Assuring them that I was buying a ticket regardless. I was told back four seats for this, and I think they're continuing to screen into next week because it's done really, really good business.
It always does. It's, it's been in circulation. Like I've seen it at the IFI as well recently.
Yeah,
it's
fantastic. And this is the new Christopher Nolan approved unrestored print, of course. Like 2001 is a film I've seen at least a dozen times at this point. You know, I saw it at a foolishly early age and just totally fell in love. Despite this being my third time seeing it in a cinema, I think partially because of the audio of 70 and my own placement, IFI being a particularly good cinema, it did feel like a new experience in that I never quite got the sort of all-surrounding sense of Hal and the way he's just boomed at you from every speaker, which I, because of the size and setup of previous cinemas, didn't really get that sense. It's incredible. And it really, I think, it got me thinking about the way the film juxtaposes internal and external, personal and sort of wider public spaces.
But yeah, so it's an experience. So.
Yeah, yeah, and that's exactly the kind of thing that's what I said on Twitter, the experiential immensity of it, the size of the screen and the volume of the like, and the way Kubrick obviously juxtaposed that with the silence of space, which was, you know, singled out at the time, this really impressive way of representing space. Space is always loud in film, and you get the
contrasting silence.
Yeah, the absolute silence. It was really, really incredible, and a lot of people there. And I think most people at this point in the crowd had probably seen it. Everybody seemed to be there to re-experience it in a new way. But it's sort of incomparable as a theatrical experience. And I was really struck in it the way that it... you don't really appreciate, again, when you're at home watching by yourself or even with a couple of different people, that long lead-in they have, both into the after the interval and before the film. It's this strange, with the lights like dialed down but not off, as is the correct
way to
instructions per Kubrick.
Well, he did. He's in projections instructions.
Yeah. Very, very detailed. Yeah. And it's this strange thing of, for 5 minutes, you get this weird audio, and you're looking around going, should the screen be on? And sort of taking stock of the world around you, going, we're all gathered in this room to see this thing. And it brings it back to what, to me, is the essence of the film. You know, it's about the search for meaning and what makes us human and all that. And by the end of the film, you've spent 2.5 hours trying to find that out with a huge crowd of other people in your own intimate personal world, yet in a very public space with them. And the contrast between those... I've always been sort of key to the film for me, but experiencing it with a crowd and in such good quality, it's sort of revelatory new experience. So very, very much recommended.
Cool. I have many sins to confess right now.
Oh dear. Yes. I think we can guess what it is.
I've never
seen.
It's in the IFI.
I know.
And now
in
you
the
know.
IFI in
and
and
now,
also
and
all
now
the
exactly
films
you know where
that
to
all
sit.
The films Ronan mentioned.
Yeah.
I've never seen.
Now you know where to sit.
Yeah.
Now you know where to sit.
Now I know where to sit.
There are tickets still available. An extra screening next week.
Go for
and
it.
Yeah. I think on Tuesday.
Yeah.
I brought a friend along who had never seen it before, and I said to him, you have to take this opportunity. If you've never seen it, this is definitely going to be the way to do it. And he sort of walked out dazed, like, what is that? I don't know what that was, but it's
because I still, even though, you know, it's so ingrained to the pop culture and that, I still don't know what it is. I still don't know what it's about.
That's great.
Nobody can tell you what it's about. You have to experience
it
for yourself.
It's sort of intensely...
You know the sound bites? Like, I think that's really...
Yeah.
You know.
There are so many things that are easy to parody in it. Certain characters, certain shots even. But you can do that without, you know, touching the overall narrative sense of it.
Yeah. I don't think I know anything about the narrative.
Yeah.
Like nothing.
Well, that's
probably
the
best way to see it. Like, I mean,
experience,
and it's remarkable for a film that is at this stage, what, 50, 60 years old now?
Yeah. And then...
50th anniversary.
I don't know... if I've seen any classic noirs. Like any properly classic noir.
Oh, yeah.
Like Maltese Falcon?
Nope.
Double Indemnity?
No. Oh, so many classics.
Like, seriously.
So
like,
little time.
You could have, like, a noir night out, you might say. And you could just treat me. Because I have no
that
idea.
That sounds like the best.
I think we need to organize a noir nuit for...
Oh, that's lovely.
Oh, don't do that.
What?
Do that, but don't call it that.
Yeah. Oh, fine. And otherwise, what else we watch? Or
other cinema experiences, revisiting But It's a New Release, Dawn Foreman's The Image You Missed, which we've talked about to excess on this podcast.
And we'll be talking about again in the news.
Oh, indeed. So I won't go into it too much, but, you know, I've said all I love about it.
It shouldn't
so far.
Be
it's,
the image that you miss.
There you go, exactly. It's my favorite new release of the year. It's absolutely terrific. Also screened this week in the IFI on 16mm was The Patriot Game by Foreman's father, McCaig, which features heavily in The Image You Missed. Which is really impressive. It's actually a student film, which I didn't realize from his days as a film student in Paris. And it's so, realizing that, because I had previously seen it in researching The Image You Missed, but realizing that, it kind of makes sense. Some of the structural things, you get the sense that he was told you need to do this and this and this in your film. But it's got this incredible footage. You know, he became very, very friendly with the Provisional IRA and just got a lot of footage with them, of them training, going around, protests, resisting the British Army, and it's really incredible stuff. You know, some of the stuff that we just haven't seen before on film, or I certainly haven't anyway. Also, I did the usual thing of trying to keep up with stuff that was just about to expire on Mubi. So, now gone, but absolutely wonderful, and find some other way.
Yeah. If you have Mubi, you can't watch it, because we waited so long to tell you about it.
I'm sorry, I'm bad at keeping up. John Cassavetes' Minion Moscovitz, which is not often talked about in his, you know, top few. You haven't heard of it, obviously. You hear a lot about Faces and these kind of things. It's really terrific. It's this really funny rom-com that's also absolutely incredibly dark. It's this woman who is savagely beaten by her lover, who's having an affair with his wife to be with her. She goes off and meets this incredibly angry, temperamental parking attendant, and they have the most strangely abusive relationship as they get to know each other over the course of a couple of days, and it's weirdly touching. it's done in such a way, and Cassavetes,
broken people, kind of,
yeah, exactly that kind of thing. And you know, you're shrieking at the television, saying, "Please get away from one another. This is not going to end well for either of you." And yet they connect. You know, they find a common humanity, and you're sort of sitting there going, like, you're kind of good for each other. It's really hilariously funny.
Okay.
I crack up watching it so much because you have that sort of bizarre simmering tension. And I think it's like the way horror and comedy work really well together. It's this sort of emotional horror, and then you get a moment of puncturing that, and it's really terrific. I'd expected, doing a bit of reading about it beforehand, it's a lot of people saying, oh, this is minor Cassavetes. For me, it's maybe my favorite that I've seen of his.
What?
It's absolutely wonderful. Gina Rowlands, is she plays the lead in it. My God, his wife at the time. She's just phenomenal. She really takes the role and runs away with it. I had the best time with it. Really recommend it.
All right, so Graham, what have you watched this week?
I watched several films. I watched one that I can't remember the amount of times I've watched it now. Hot Fuzz. It's on Netflix. I do this thing where if I'm writing something, like either a video game or film, or just I'm just writing just to write, I have something on in the background that maybe I know, but I can still hear. And just, I play a little radio drama, trying to remember it in my head, and I just kept finding myself looking up from the laptop and just taking it in again.
Destroying my own productivity.
And exactly. And I was just like, this to me was the pinnacle of the trifecta of Pegg, Wright, and Frost. I think this was their best one.
Oh, yeah.
I think Shaun of the Dead was them finding their feet. And I think End of the World...
Or World End.
World End, excuse me, the other one. Is
The other one.
Yeah.
The other one.
I will stand up for World's End.
Oh, please sit down.
World's End is more of a... It's more of a thought piece, really, about growing up than it is a comedy, I find, because I watched that recently as well. I was like, I'm not laughing, but it's very... The older I get, the more this film makes sense. Mm. So that's the only kind of old film that I watched. I discovered, finally, Train to Busan.
Oh, wow.
Finally watched that with my girlfriend.
It's great,
my little sister. My little sister was over for Dublin Comic Con, and so we had just one night of just hanging out, just eating garbage and watching films. And Train to Busan. I had recorded Train to Busan. It was on film 4. Never seen it, and just said, just please record it.
Yeah.
and I watched it and was blown away at how emotionally engaged I was. Yeah. I was like, and I just realized, I've loved zombie films. I think they're all brilliant. The Walking Dead at a time was one of the best TV shows on television.
A very brief time.
Very brief time. There was, I think it was season 4 when they first entered the prison, was maybe their highlight season for me. I think that's season 4, okay. It might be season 3.
I'd go with the first 8 episodes before they fired Frank Darabont, but that's okay. Just me.
And basically, I've never connected emotionally so strong and so strongly with a cast in a zombie film. Like, either it's comedy and it kind of cuts away from the tension, or it's too gory and it's like, I can't
invest in these people because they're going to be eaten.
And what I found so interesting was the characters.
I can't emotionally do it.
I can't. Because it's just like, it's too gory. Like, a lot of people go, well, Dawn of the Dead. It's just, but none of the characters were, like, they might have a little soundbite moments, a lot of lines, but they're not that interesting. At least I found. I mean, Zack Snyder's films are great. I'm only kidding. It's not that one.
Some arch eyebrows there for a moment.
It's not that one. It's not that one. It's the original.
So you're saying the original is shite?
No, I like the original. I love the original. And the original is scary. The original is scary.
Yeah.
But there was something so emotional. And I find this with a lot of Asian films is they're able to do a really good subtext on top of a lot of their stories. Like even films like Shin Godzilla, which I saw last year, had an amazing subtext about government and all the red tape you have to get past to get things done on top of having to face an atomic monster. And it was just like, it was so well done. And then what's Train to Busan is just like, it's just so clever. Like the story of parenthood, of making those kind of issues. And I also love the design of the zombies. They're never called zombies. How they move, how they like, they don't care to eat. It's not about eating. It's literally just about, it's a disease just trying to spread. And like with the second they bite you, they leave you alone and then move on. I found that, the simplicity of that I found really interesting. And I love the characters. I just thought it was really well done. And I walked away from it really happy and in a stifling tears. And my girlfriend and sister were in full tears.
You know, his follow-up's on Netflix.
He's got a follow-up.
It's on Netflix. It's a cataclysm, catastrophe. It's some sort of one like that.
Check that
it's
out.
A found footage sort of superhero one. Apparently it's quite worth a look. It's interesting.
And there's a sequel possibly coming to Train to Busan? That's what I heard recently.
If it's not the 3:10 to Busan, I'm going to be very disappointed.
And then the last, one of the other films that I watched was Detective D, The Four Heavenly Kings. Which is part of a series of films about Detective D, who is the basically Sherlock Holmes set in the, I believe, the Chinese dynasty, and it's a fictional take on the Empire of China, Empire of China, and it's ridiculous. Like it has CGI gorillas.
I've seen one of these. I think the mystery of the Phantom Flame or something. I can't remember what it was called.
That's one of them.
And the CGI was knowingly nonsense.
Yeah.
And after about 10 minutes, I was like, I'm going with this. I'm going to go along. Because otherwise, they're going to sit here with my arms folded.
This is an image of Ronan sitting in the back seat with his arm going.
It's
no.
just like, and this is the latest entry. And it's just it's a fictionalized version of actual events that happened in China, and it's
just with more CGI gorillas.
Oh God, yeah, like way more, as in like one, which is way more CGI.
It's at least 100% more.
Yeah, and it's a brilliant film. Like I absolutely adored it because it's basically like Chinese. God, I hope it's Chinese because I'm trying to remember. It's Asian Sherlock because this guy is just so intelligent. But not only that, like, the martial arts are really good, the characters are really interesting.
Okay, so it's actually got good production outside of the CGI.
I don't know if it's ever going to come here to cinema, because it was shown for Cinasia, which is a branch in the UK that promotes Asian film that comes out there. I don't know if it's ever going to show here, but it's absolutely brilliant, and I'm just a little annoyed that this is the latest entry, because I would have liked to watch the other two in chronological order. But the thing is, they're like episodes. They're like episodic. Basically, you see moments in his career, yeah. And it's a lot of fun. Because the thing is, I think The Phantom Flame is the predecessor to this one. Like it literally follows up directly after the events of The Phantom Flame. And then the final film that I watched, at least to my memory, is Christopher Robin.
Ah,
yes, and it was okay. Oh, I've been listening to a lot of critics and that talk about Christopher Robin, and it just, it worsens every time I hear more thoughts come out about it, because then it just like opens like thought bubbles going, oh, it is that. Oh, no, it is that.
Oh.
And it's just like, I liked Christopher Robin, but I realized, watch afterwards, if Jim Cummings, who voices Winnie and, Pooh, and he voices Tigger as well, from the 90s TV show that we would have watched, if he wasn't there, I don't know if I would have been nearly as invested as I was, because Ewan McGregor's not great, Hayley Atwell's not in it nearly enough, and it's a weirdly dark take on your childhood and how
isn't as weirdly dark as Goodbye Christopher Robin.
No, nothing is as dark as Goodbye Christopher Robin. But is it a little bit weird that the two Christopher Robin films are both surprisingly dark? Paddington is rocking the world right now. I can't wait for the third one.
I imagine that says something about the world more than it says anything about Winnie the Pooh, to be fair. But I do like that shortly before Fox was purchased by Disney, they were like, okay, screw you guys, we're making a Winnie the Pooh movie, and it's gonna be dark.
Goodbye Christopher Robin is... It's basically the true Hollywood story of Christopher Robin, it is dark.
It's behind the bear, so to speak.
You think you have an idea? You have no... idea.
Yeah. You want to feel, not only do you want to feel like you can never love Winnie the Pooh again, do you want to feel guilty about all the time that you used to love Winnie the Pooh?
Mm-hmm.
That's Goodbye Christopher Robin.
Goodbye Christopher Robin has that. And then when you go to Christopher Robin, it's like, hey, you know when you forget about your imaginary friends? Yeah, well, guess what? They don't forget about you, and they might be sad and lonely.
That's a great message to send a kid, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like, don't ever forget about your imaginary friends.
Both films are too ingrained in the idea of adults need to be reminded of their childhood. Yeah, but please make sure that the childhood itself is still remains intact.
Well, also that I arguably probably says a lot about modern pop culture in general, I would contend.
Absolutely.
But that's a whole other podcast. So myself, I watched a bunch of stuff. I watched PK, which is the Aamir Khan 2014 Alien Arrives in India film. Interesting exploration of religion, Stranger from a Strange Land, The Man Who Fell to Earth, but with more Bollywood dance numbers.
How many?
It has the obligatory six, I believe. Six tends to
be there. I love that that's...
Well, it's very formulaic. Six. Yeah, it's very formulaic. It's nice. It's charming. It's not as good as his best stuff. It's not as good as, say, Lagan Once Upon a Time in India, in terms of like that old-style, regal, sort of MGM-type quality that a lot of the Bollywood productions can have. It's also not as like modern, like contemporary sort of... like Hollywood style, let's say Dangal was last year. This is a little bit more esoteric, and it's very much anchored in Indian culture. It's a film that is about religion, and in particular forms of religion as they exist in India at the moment. It's very much aimed at exploring some of the country's issues around, or sort of discussions that they're having around secularization, mm-hmm. and also around religious belief, and in particular, say, the gurus. So it's a bit more esoteric than some of his other stuff. It's fun, it's light, it's incredibly charming. Khan is a wonderful physical comedian. He models his character on Charlie Chaplin, which is quite impressive. It means that a lot of the humor carries across, you know, despite the fact that it's in Bhojpuri, which is halfway between Hindu and English.
Is what kind of alien is he? Is he like an ET alien, or is he a super bad alien?
No, he's just an alien.
Oh, okay. He's just an alien.
He's a guy. Yeah, he's a guy who looks like Aamir Khan, except he's poked out his ears. He's wearing contact lenses, and he's eating sweets to make his mouth red. So outside of that, it's fascinating. No, Aamir Khan is an absolutely fascinating actor, if only because in the films that I've seen of him, and I won't pretend to be an expert in like the Khan filmology, but in terms of what I've seen of his work, every single role that he plays, he transforms himself physically, but only from the neck up. He's always a V from like the... he's always a V shape from his shoulders to his waist. So it's like he's Daniel Day-Lewis from the neck up, but he's Tom Cruise from the neck down. It's something to behold. So you have this scene where this lovable, dorky alien who's wandering around with red lips, poking out ears, and a gigantic yellow helmet so God can see him from above, is also, when he gets undressed, built like a tank.
Naturally,
as you do. Apparently they have great gyms off planet.
Is he the Indian Tom Cruise?
No, he's much better. I like Tom Cruise.
Tom Cruise is the American him.
Yeah, if he's lucky. I also watched The Open House, which is a horror film available on Netflix, which I had not heard of. I didn't even know existed.
I don't believe I have either.
It was one of those mass purchases. $8 million. It was bought at a film festival in November of last year.
Good Lord.
Released quietly, very, very quietly, in the middle of January on Netflix.
Why are they doing this?
Well,
$8 million is a hype, but they're not going to make that back in subscriptions. Nobody's going to sign up for Open House.
Well, the idea why they bought this one in particular is because the actor in it, who is Dylan Minnette, who plays Logan, the other generic name that they have for people, but he plays Logan in it. He starred in 13 Reasons Why. And the idea is they purchased it so that they would have something when you reach the end of the first season, 13 Reasons Why, while waiting for the second, they could go, we also recommend this.
Very good.
Which is interesting.
That is fascinating.
It is. It's absolutely fascinating how these things are constructed.
As long as the main guy in it.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
What they're
actually Goosebumps. He's in that.
What they're trying to do is they're trying to basically Netflix since 2010 have lost 25% of their film library,
mm-hmm.
Which will surprise nobody who's been on Netflix.
Yep.
So what they're literally trying to do is they're trying to build up that bulk in terms of original productions. Mm-hmm. So that's why stuff like this ends up there. And the reason I was watching it was because it was the first Netflix movie to make either the IMDb's best 250 movies of all time or the worst 250 movies.
No points for guessing which.
No points for guessing which one. It's an interesting film. It's not a good one by any stretch of the imagination, but it's fascinating because it taps into it, demonstrates the way in which horror, even when horror is bad, and horror is often bad to be fair to it, taps into fears that reflect the world that we live in now. It's called The Open House. There's a scene in the middle of the movie where the characters arrive back at the scenic mountain house that they're renting from the mother's sister who's selling her house. At which point the young man turns to his mother and says, have you ever thought about how strange an open house is? I mean, you just leave your house open all day. Strangers come in. You give your keys to somebody you don't even know. And then they leave. And they probably don't even check to make sure that everybody's left the house. No points for guessing what the horror in this movie actually involves.
Someone took a poop in their toilet.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. But it goes on for 94 minutes inexplicably. But it taps into that sort of economic anxiety that you see. And it's a lot like if you look at mainstream horror, so you look at movies like The Conjuring, you look at movies like, obviously, The Conjuring 2, for example, but even the Annabelle movies. They're all tapping into this idea, the 70s idea of, like, haunted houses in a way that reflects economic anxiety, like in the 70s, where you had stuff like Amityville, for example, and all that, and Poltergeist, even in the 80s, where the American house has become this sort of, like, monstrous, burdensome thing because nobody can afford to pay their mortgages on, and everybody's living in houses that are so big that serial killers can secretly hide in the basement and nobody will know. And isn't that horrible? And it's fascinating, but it unfortunately is not good. And then I also saw Upgrade, which is getting an Irish release here later in the month, I believe, but it's available to stream online from Movies Anywhere at the moment, so you can actually perfectly legally watch it online for a certain amount of money.
It's been America for a while.
It's been out in America since like June, July. This is the weird distribution model that we have now where it no longer makes any sense to delay or stagger releases. But Upgrade is fascinating. Again, I really enjoyed it. It is not necessarily a great film. I think it's a good one, if only because it fundamentally understands body horror.
Yeah.
In that the idea of body horror is the realization that you are
you're an
operating system working on a machine made of meat, and your body is both fragile and non-responsive, and your mind isn't ideally suited to pilot it anyway, so you're a bit screwed no matter what happens. But the plot of the movie follows a gentleman who gets a chip installed in him that provides him with a computer-augmented operating system akin to Siri or Google Home that will operate his body.
I would
body.
Say Kit.
Yeah, that will operate his body for him. With hilarious results, and by hilarious I mean terrifying.
Okay, I thought you were going to tell me it's a comedy.
No, it's not. That would be great. The body swap comedy where the swap is Siri into your body. But there's several points in the movie. It stars Logan Marshall Green, and there are several points in the movie, and these are the moments where it really works, where the character surrenders control of his body to this artificial intelligence, and this artificial intelligence proceeds to use his body in a way that is incredibly unnatural and uncanny. And during these sequences, you'll occasionally see the body moving, but the camera will tend to focus on Logan Marshall Green's face in these moments of beautiful black comedy where you can see his brain processing what his body's doing and reacting in sheer terror. It suffers from several problems, unfortunately, a lot of them down to the fact that it's a low-budget, zero-budget B-movie. The cast is not fantastic. The plot itself is very basic and rudimentary. It's a standard revenge narrative that drives the plot. But its themes, its ideas, and its world-building and its technique, and even its understanding of the genre are also very good.
Yeah, I've heard very good things about it from America, from pundits who are in America, who just seem to really just enjoy the idea of surrendering to this force and just kind of watching this guy. Like, apparently, like, Logan... He's very great facial actor.
His body
is literally moving independent of him.
He's got that sort of John Cena type quality where you put a camera on his face and ask him to imagine things and it's just beautiful. It's like work of art. I will stand by like Blockers as like one of the comic highlights of the year.
I will back you up.
The reaction shots. Like if the movie were composed entirely of a camera focused on John Cena's face, it would be a masterpiece. It would be a 5-star.
Especially during that drinking scene.
Not the drink. Even the house, the breaking into the house or the sneaking around the house. But again.
Even remembering it. Yeah. It's like, it's comedy gold.
But yeah, so that is what I watched this week. Let's take a look then at what's happening internationally. What's happening in Irish and internationally in terms of film news. Darren occasionally says sentences right. So in terms of Irish film, there is Black 47, Rosie, Vita and Virginia are added to the 2018 Toronto International Film Festival, which is a pretty good showing for Ireland. Black 47 actually just today got an American distribution deal with IFC Films. So they'll be distributing, I think, in somewhere around 100 cinemas, which is pretty good.
It's very soon to open here in extremely wide release.
Yeah. It is. It's screening, I believe, in every Omniplex?
Yeah,
which is pretty great. It may be one of the widest openings of an Irish film ever.
So imagine in the next year a lot of Irish and American outlets writing about the potato famine.
Amazing.
To be fair, like...
did you guys know about that Ireland had a potato famine? Yes. Yes, we did.
Well, I may have heard of that once or twice.
It makes a nice difference from the other stereotype of Irish
people. That is
true. Yeah. Guinness in one hand, potato in the other.
New stereotype is that we have no
potatoes.
Now
they just took the potato out.
As opposed to having all the potatoes.
Darren, now they just took the potato out of the other hand.
Yeah. You're just going to have a load of Americans going, now I get why they love potatoes.
Yeah.
God.
This is why they invented crisps.
That's why they have them in this. That's why they have them in stews.
Yeah, they have to ration them.
It's the Mr. Tato origin story.
Actually, now they might be like... So now they're just like flagrantly like just like throwing it in everyone's faces that they have potatoes. Did they not learn from the potato that like they should ration them?
It's potato overcompensation is what we're dealing with here. In terms of other, like again, this has been a great week for Irish film abroad. Mm-hmm. The Image You Missed and The Patriot Game are both screening at the Open City Documentary Festival in London in September, which is the double feature that you caught, obviously, earlier.
Yeah, I think it's kind of essential programming, really. If you see the documentary, you're going inevitably be curious about McCaig's documentaries, and it's great to see them getting some exposure.
So that will be between the 4th and 9th of September, so if you want to make time for that. Also, Michael Inside is getting its Canadian premiere on September the 15th at the Vancouver Irish Film Festival.
Good to see. I still really, really like that film.
It is. It's
hanging in my top 10 of the year, I think.
I liked it. I thought it was a bit didactic at points, but again, it's wonderfully atmospheric. It's got some great performances, and it's incredibly
claustrophobic. Mo Dunford's brilliant in it.
I think the entire ensemble. Roddy Lawler is fantastic as well.
He's amazing.
So I think that sort of wraps up the week in film news. Let's take a look at everybody's favorite part of the program, the top 10.
Woohoo.
That should be the lead-in.
How a little bit of theme music.
Extremely unenthusiastic.
This is where this segment begins.
Yeah, woohoo.
Grand.
Okay, fine. Do you guys want to take a guess at what's at number 10? Oh, no, there's no way anybody's guessing this. Although, Ronan, I'm actually surprised you haven't seen this. It is the true story of the most decorated dog in American military history, Sergeant Stubby, and the enduring bonds he forged with his brothers in arms in the trenches in World War I. Sergeant Stubby, an unlikely hero.
Sergeant Stubby. That's not the full title, I hope.
That is an unlikely hero. Sergeant Stubby, an unlikely hero.
Okay, never mind. It's still worse.
Well, frankly, he's a dog that's a very likely hero.
Yeah. What? Well, I mean, in the First World War.
Oh.
Sorry, I've just shown Ronan the little picture. He's
I'm
like,
extremely
see, you thought I was being.
Where is this showing? I want it.
Oh, that's so cute.
Do you want me to? Okay, let's go to the.
Oh, my God.
I mean, come on. Like, it's very rare that we manage to bring joy to people's lives. I mean, think about how much you were dreading. How much you were dreading reaching the top 10, and then this arrives. This little.
I have no problem whatsoever with the top
next
10.
Next time you come back.
So it's currently screening. It's currently screening in Omniplex, Dublin, Rathmines, IMC Tala, or IMC Dundalk. And
one of those is reachable.
Screening through at least next Wednesday.
Okay.
It is computer generated.
Oh no, you just lost us completely there. If we can get it to number 10 for next week, I'll feel morally obliged to go see it.
At number 9, it's Unfriended Dark Web.
You can talk about this.
I really enjoyed this.
Is it good?
It's excellent. Well, I mean, you know, it with qualifications, it is good in the way that a horror movie, standard conventional, like non-genre busting, Get Out style, you know, sort of Silence of the Lambs, sure. Transcendent sort of horror movie, like conventional sort of popcorn horror movie can be good. It's got a lot of the logical problems that you expect with that, in that there are a lot of contrivances necessary to move the plot. It's got some issues with characterization, where it's like it wants you to be attached to these characters, but just attached enough that you don't mind what happens to them at all. And it's also sort of suffers a little bit in terms of pacing, where it's heavily backloaded. So you have a good 45 minutes of setting stuff up before you hit, you know, what for the movie is payola. But those qualifications aside, I absolutely loved it. It is fantastic. It's highly energetic. It's very clever. I would argue it's probably better than the original Unfriended, even though the original Unfriended has an advantage in terms of novelty. And we're still at a stage, and myself and Graham may end up talking about this in a future podcast when Searching comes out, but we're at a stage where people are still sort of figuring out the language of constructing films around these sort of stuff. You know, in the way that you could argue this is the 2010s equivalent of found footage horror movies, where it's like people are trying to figure out how you make a story suspenseful and how you maintain tension and how you keep things moving as it's going along. And there are a lot of like forced like narrative elements in there that are very clearly there because you need them to be in front of a laptop when this horrible thing happens. But it is insanely clever. It is probably the only movie this year that will manage to sneak in references to everything from like Cambridge Analytical to the Trump election to, you know, to basically the wide range. Oh, to doxing, and they even have swatting in there as well. Ronan is looking at me with sheer confusion on his face.
I just don't know what any of these
what the kids
mean.
Are doing these days. But it is remarkably au fait with this. So it genuinely feels like it's written by somebody who, you know, the way lots of teenage horror movies are generally written by people who have maybe encountered a teenager once or twice and are writing from that memory. Yeah. This feels it was at least written by somebody who has like a tab open on, say, The Verge or something, because they understand these concepts.
That's a vulture.
Yes, that's it, exactly. And I mean, one of the biggest complaints about it is the fact that it is questionable whether it's best classified as a horror movie or just a straight up thriller, but it arguably works because of that. It has a much realer sense of horror than the original Unfriended did, because it understands how to translate horror conventions into the new age. So for example, like the first Unfriended, not to get too spoiler, was what if Facebook was haunted, which is, you know, it's like halfway towards getting a modern horror movie, whereas this is like, okay, we're going to take elements like classic horror movie stuff like cults. We're going to wonder, what would a cult look like if we did this on the internet age? Oh, 4chan! Let's go to 4chan! And so
4chan
on.
Would be the place.
4chan would be the place.
4chan would be the place. Also, I'm just imagining like the promotional campaign of Unfriended just being, what if Facebook was haunted? Just like you just going on the screen going, what if Facebook was haunted? And your hands are up like this.
Yeah. Listeners can't see my hands. I was doing jazz hands when I hit upon that pitch. I do love the
jazz hands?
Yeah. But
wasn't sure where you were going, so just like jazz hands?
No, no, I just love the idea of that being the pull quote.
Oh, that'd be amazing. Facebook, like as a quote, like someone.
But it has to have exclamation marks. In
face
there as well.
Boo.
What a face boo. Oh, there we go.
There you go. There's your title.
Yeah. But no, it's very good. I would wholeheartedly if you have any tolerance whatsoever, I would wholeheartedly recommend it.
It's really funny that you have to have a tolerance for it though. That's what that's.
You've got to be prepared to subject yourself
that's
to something
recommendation,
not very good.
If you have a tolerance for this, then I recommend it.
At number 8, it's Teen Titans Go to the Cinema.
I still haven't seen that, and I'm really annoyed about that.
Great fun. No, no, you're not it.
No, it's no a, as in I haven't seen
a,
it. Not
it's
no
a superhero
it's not
movie
fun.
Of the summer. What if it had a heroic dog in it?
Well, then I'm in.
Does it?
No.
No? Ace the Bat Hound doesn't make a cameo?
Doesn't, unfortunately.
Oh.
At number 7, it's The Darkest Minds.
I did not see that.
I missed that as well. This is the young adult novel from, and this is the one where they're selling it.
No, it's the X-Men.
Yeah, but they're selling it. This is the one where we're now selling movies not from the director of or the writer of, but from the producer of Stranger Things and Arrival.
I really feel like the reason being is because it's like Stranger Things and Arrival. Just like, hey, look, these two things did really well and are really great, so just. Boom.
Yeah.
From also, the cinema also that once showed.
Yeah, from the cinema where we probably screened.
This is a thing that's been creeping up over the last couple of years. When did producer become a thing? It's like, because the producer.
I feel like at some point during
that important at the end of the day for the style and the substance on the film?
It depends
style,
on the film.
Style, not necessarily. Yeah. Well, but they're absolutely keen on.
I mean, Poltergeist.
They're
how many decades ago was that?
Two or three. But anyway. But I mean.
But that's what I mean.
Producer would have been incredibly important like 70, 80 years ago.
During the studio system.
But they're because studio systems are so strong again now, they're really trying to dig it up again.
Yeah. It's just funny because it's like, there's so many things of like saying, from the producer. It's from the, like, it's just like, kids won't care about that. If you just say, kids will not care, people will not care.
But it allows you to put the name of something in there. And yeah, I mean, like we've talked about this before in the podcast where Truth or Dare was marketed as from the studio that brought you Get Out, where it is trying to, like, the idea is that now we're sort of moving away from the idea of even movie stars. We're moving more towards, like, intellectual property stuff. Yeah. So it's, if you can tie it into, in any way, something that people like. And I mean, that's why, for example, Jordan Peterson sort of producing films now is a huge deal. Even if he's not directing them.
I mean
Jordan Peele, sorry.
big difference.
Oh, big difference.
But I think it also plays into this sort of, ignorance seems like a harsh word, but wider misunderstanding maybe of the roles in production. You know, the average person on the street may not know the intimate difference between a director and a producer or a writer or anything. So they
like
just see something there.
If you
and
ask
like,
someone on the street, what does a producer do? That would be the noise.
Yeah, they just want to see, ooh, from someone who was involved
in
this other thing.
Yeah, someone who's involved in.
From the catering company that worked on.
They might be involved in just the least insular way.
And I have previously seen from the executive producer, which is really just
is the guy.
From my nan's
ass. That's it.
It's an executive producer is literally just the person
pretty
who writes
much,
the checks.
Or maybe makes a reference. It's like, you should talk to this person.
Or, you know, recently bought a part of the production, like how... What was it? Alec Baldwin was producer eventually of 30 Rock, and Andy Samberg is now producer of.
But that's 9-9. That can also be when stars basically leverage themselves into a stronger position. So Maggie Gyllenhaal is a producer on The Deuce, for example, to take one example of something I watched recently. At number six, it's Incredibles 2. It's performing very, very well. 3.7 million euro to date, and it's
good
not
grief.
Going anywhere.
Good for them.
Yeah, the kids it's these days.
Film.
Well, I mean, it's either that or Sergeant Stubbs.
Yeah, well, they've made the wrong choice, frankly. Yeah.
Or it's Christopher Robin. That's out now.
At number five, Hotel Transylvania 3, Monster Vacation.
I'm really annoyed I missed that. Aww. I've seen the first two, and they're really good.
I liked the first two. I didn't love them. I liked them sort of
it's
more than Looney Tunes.
Jendy
Tarkovsky,
I can't pronounce the second name. Is such a great director and storyteller, and the animation style is just so fluid. It's like the natural step from 2D animation to 3D. Like the way the movement and everything is it's just so comedic and just so form flowing that I adored it. And also like the cast are actually it's Adam Sandberg when he's actually trying.
Adam Sandler.
I combined them because Andy Samberg is no, but Andy Samberg is also in that film. He's the son-in-law. He's the son-in-law. Yeah.
All right. That's no worries. At number four.
Number four.
It is Mission Impossible Fallout,
nice.
Which is still my film of the summer. I'm sorry, Ronan.
I
feel like I have to preempt.
What's?
We'll get to it.
Yeah, we'll get to it.
Is it higher?
Yeah, of course it is.
I don't know what it is. What are you talking about?
It's going to be a surprise.
Yeah.
You'll recognize it because when I say the name,
there'll
be a reaction.
But yeah, Mission Impossible Fallout, aka the mustache game, aka Henry Cavill beats the shit out of, I swear.
you can swear, we're grown-ups here. At number three, it's Ant-Man and the Wasp.
Which what week of release is it for this? Is this its third, fourth week?
This is its third week, I think.
It had a front page ad in the Irish Times today, which strikes me as strange in a third week of release. I think it's desperate to get to the top spot.
Because we all know why.
Yeah, we know why. Because somebody is hanging on to that top spot, like
deservedly. it's really strange to see that in the third week to sort of push in new
really
market.
Go for it. I think the reason why is
and that number three as well. Like,
exactly.
I think the reason why is because I think maybe Disney are regretting that they pushed it off for a month.
Yeah, it was probably not a very great idea.
I think they were like, we shouldn't have done that.
Yeah.
People would have gone to have seen that film.
And it does. It has this strange hint of desperation. They're throwing money at the problem. Because when you think about the targeting, like the front
to
page of
fair,
the Irish
Disney
Times is not...
I love the idea of like Irish Times would go, why? Yeah. Have you heard about this?
Yeah. I say,
Donal, have you heard about this? I have not, Colin.
Ant Man and the Wasp.
Oh, it's one of those socio-political movies. White Anglo-Saxon Protestant.
I don't know this Paul Rudd character.
Paul Rudd.
They're saying it's a ruddy good time, though.
Evangeline.
But yes.
Oh, my.
So, yes.
Let's see how that pays off, right? Number
yeah,
two
so
next week.
Next week, we're angling for the top spot. Let's see if it can grow its audience, eh?
Oh.
Oh, okay. Sorry. That was a little pun.
He's not
there.
Called Giant Man, yes. He's still Ant-Man.
At number two, it's The Meg.
Ah.
Boo.
Which is not...
Seems
not
to have disappointed everyone.
Not deserving.
No, yeah.
And yet it's made so much money at the American box office.
Sharks,
it does
man,
not
they
deserve...
sell.
People like sharks.
It
doesn't like sharks and stays.
It
doesn't sell.
Deserve its place. It is an awful
as
film.
Opposed to all the other number one movies at the international box office.
I know, but still, it's just like there's no thought, there's no creativity, there's no style, there's nothing to this film save for a British man who doesn't even kick a shark. We wanted to see Jason Statham kick a shark, we didn't even get that.
It's bizarre to me that they would not put that in that film.
It's so
that's
weird.
Why people are going to the cinema.
Well,
to see
there,
Jason
there are
does he punch the shark?
He's one kick man. No.
There are precisely two shots worth your time in this movie.
I want to know every way he physically interacts with the shark.
That's it. There's only one way he physically interacts with the shark.
Two shots?
No.
There are two shots that are worth watching.
Oh,
one of them... Okay, we
it's
won't
very
go to
close to the end.
They're both very close to the end. We won't go into spoilers here. But it suffers from that thing where modern blockbusters have to be bigger and bigger and bigger. So this is three blockbusters crammed together. Like, it's like, okay, we've discovered the bottom of the floor is secretly a hydrogen gas, and underneath there's a secret kingdom filled with dinosaurs. And you're like, oh, I want to watch this movie. It's like 30 minutes later, it's too bad, because we're going back up and we're doing Jaws. It's like, okay, I guess I can watch this movie too. It's like, too bad, we're doing Jurassic Park, but with beaches. And it's like, oh. But it
not the film with Bette Midler and
that would be
Anne Hesh.
Tell me you wouldn't watch Anne Hesh and Bette Midler in
take
Jurassic
on,
Park.
Take on the Meg.
Absolutely,
I would totally watch
but
that.
It's also crammed in that nothing has any room to breathe. There's a great moment where, like, after an early scene, where they do that thing where character definitions, like the stuff that you read in pitches or in scripts, they're no longer like on the log lines or the audition lines. They're actually in dialogue. It's like there's a moment where after the lead character comes up, one of the other characters goes, "You left him behind because that's who you are." And there's another moment where
that's what you do.
That's who you are. That's literally who you are. That is your definition as a character. This is your arc in this movie. And then Jason Statham turns to his friend and says, "Mac, this is why I don't do this anymore." And
it's weird that you know Mac's name, but you don't know Jason Statham's.
Yeah,
it's
well, he's just
Jonah.
That's what
he's credited as.
Is it funny how they came very close to calling him Jonah?
And yeah. I maybe would have given the movie a bit more credit if they'd done that.
There are whales in this film,
like,
and they suffer a terrible thing.
Is the name just a contraction of some sort of shark name?
Like the Megalodon.
Yeah, I thought so.
Yeah, that's exactly.
A real shark?
But like,
I think
is
that's a real prehistoric creature.
It was, but it was only 30 feet long. The one in this movie is 60 feet long.
Of course.
And you know what? That's still not big enough. It's still boring.
But I don't think the size of the shark is the issue. In fact, I'd argue the size of the shark is part of the problem. But it's again the whole thing. Like, it has this big thing where, like, they have Rainn Wilson as the evil venture capitalist, the Elon Musk supervillain. But he has this scene where he's doing the thing that they do in these movies where he's like, "Look, I realize that a lot of your friends are dead as a result of this expedition that I funded, right? But you gotta think of the big picture. we can monetize this shark. And you're like, oh, they're going to do the thing where his greedy capitalism leads the monster getting loose. And it's going to be a commentary on that. It's like, no, we ain't got time for that. The room shakes. It's like, oh my God, there's a giant shark.
Because apparently the shark is smart enough to go after them?
Yeah.
But not smart enough
have
to know...
Have you not seen Jaws the Revenge, Graham?
No, I have not seen Jaws the Revenge.
It's practically
I've
a documentary.
I've also not seen Jaws 1, 2...
That's not
2,
the one that Michael Caine, is it?
Is that the third one?
That's Jaws 4, I think.
That is Jaws the Revenge. It's the one with the voodoo shark. The one where the shark... No, the one where the shark... So basically, Jaws the Revenge is the shark getting revenge on the people that killed it. The only irony being, it's dead, so it can't really do that. So it's a zombie shark, yes. Oh. But the novelization, right, explained how this came to be in the novelization. And I love the idea of, like, a novelist being handed the script to Jaws the Revenge and being like, there's a bit of a plot hole. It's like, just fix it. It's like, okay. Make it work. And the solution they came up with was the shark was brought back to life by voodoo.
Excellent.
And it's like, yep, job done.
What era was this? Like, what decade?
We're talking 80s.
Yeah, okay. I can see why voodoo, because I'm like, ooh, voodoo's still kind of new in horror, so...
New in horror in the 80s.
Voodoo is
like,
hot.
Voodoo's so hot right now that we only had that Roger Moore James Bond film a decade ago.
I just really don't like this film.
And at number one...
Wait.
What is it?
Really?
I still don't know.
What haven't we mentioned
I
in the
don't
top
know.
The greatest film of the summer, the greatest shoot.
Oh, God,
of
it's
summer,
Mummy 2!
Woohoo!
What's really annoying? I did like this.
It's quite
why
enjoyable.
Why is that annoying?
Yeah, why is that annoying?
It's like really annoying.
The first one.
The first one's not a great film.
Love just because it gives me such pleasure, but it is in terms of filmmaking, it is.
Also, the continuity is awful in these two films. I mean, like, the young versions of them in this film look nothing like the supposed
thank
young
goodness.
Versions.
And is that a problem?
No, it's not. They got Pierce Brosnan to dress up.
The really bad beard
really?
On
you're
on
telling me
Pierce
that Pierce
Brosnan
in a beard wouldn't have made the movie better?
Nuh-uh. Not once I saw young Pierce Brosnan.
All they have to do is stick on that, you know, that Marvel charm, that Marvel money.
Oh, the
de-aging.
Oh,
well, we're reaching the Mamma Mia expanded universe.
Yeah,
like, who's like? Are we going to do like a Beatles jukebox musical next, and then they cross over?
Just keep doing ABBA jukebox musicals.
Well,
play them again and again and again, same songs.
Yeah, because they use them as songs.
You know, like ABBA have like mountains of music.
Oh yeah,
so absolutely. They still went back to the old favorites in this.
Although in the second one, a big worry a lot of people had ahead of the second one was that they took some of the ones that they had previously done in the first and pulled a lot from the lesser known catalog.
They did.
They worked really well.
The teacher one,
it's fantastic.
That really helped me fall in love with Lily James.
And it's such
really
a good start.
Fell in love with her in this.
It's such a bizarre, strange start, and then you've got Celia Imrie belting it out in a Scottish accent, which she doesn't have, and just has put this on for no reason other than it's ridiculous and fun.
She's
done
Paddington Bear too. She has a Scottish accent in that as well.
Maybe I'm
There's
wrong,
no
and
reason.
She doesn't have a Scottish accent.
No,
she doesn't. She's English, right?
Because you see her in Graham Norton interviews, and it's just like, you're English. Yeah. Why are you always Scottish?
When I heard her putting that on, she was born in Surrey. It's absolutely bizarre.
Mm.
Well, I burst out laughing when she started doing it, and here we go again.
I just love the fact that when they're like all the like Amanda Seyfried and that are getting lifted, and she goes to get lifted and does not get lifted. It's like
Graham, very mean spirited audience.
I just find it really funny because she's just like, you're brilliant.
Yeah, no.
She is. She's absolutely terrific.
And I mean, here we go again. Will outlast us all and be the greatest showman.
I certainly hope so. I think something opened at the international box office and displaced it. Since, but it's still hanging on
it
here.
Wouldn't be the Meg, would it?
It might be.
It might be the Meg.
It might
know.
Be the
I think there was
yeah,
something else.
Like it's doing really well
there's,
in America.
There's
no, there's Equalizer 2. Equalizer 2 is in
the
States.
I think you mean the Sequelizer.
I do indeed.
But we'll talk about that in a moment. So let's move on to talk about the new releases.
I kind of feel like we talked too much about the Meg, and we didn't talk nearly enough about Mamma Mia 2.
Well, we can
talk about Mamma Mia all day long if you like.
I really liked it. It's preposterously good and heartfelt and warm and surprisingly touching.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to when the sing-along screens inevitably come along, because I've been twice now and I sang anyway, and people looked at me with those side eyes. So at least it'll be accepted the next time.
Well, I mean, everyone knows this is part of Jay's cinema of experience.
Jay is such a fanboy for this film. I think he liked it more than me. He said he cried three times.
He did.
I don't blame him.
Currently
Wait, Ron, did you go with Jay?
I know.
No. We're all going together. It's going to be like a big. It's going to be a special moment. It'll be like when we have our own Abba jukebox musical. We'll look through the picture album, and there'll just be a picture of us there.
Can I just be there when you go to the 4DX experience? I really want to be there when you go to a 4DX film
of Mamma Mia
of the Meg.
We should say, to be fair, Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again is not a perfect film.
No,
the way young Colin Firth sings Waterloo is offensive.
You mean Pound Shop, Matt Smith?
Ooh.
He is! Look at him!
Depending on who I talk to, everybody has compared him unfavorably to some other young actor. I think he's doing he does. I think he's doing a weird young Hugh Grant thing that doesn't quite work. He's basically doing young any famous English actor.
It's a choice. It's definitely a choice.
From what I was told, he's played Pierce Brosnan before as well. A young Pierce Brosnan.
Really?
Yeah, he's played a young Pierce Brosnan.
I cannot imagine that working.
And now he's played a young Colin Firth. People are just waiting for him.
And
to
we know that that doesn't work.
Yeah, we're now waiting for a young Stellan Skarsgård appearance.
Again, you have how many Skarsgård children?
It's so funny.
Eight.
There are so
eight.
Many. He's been having them for decades. Nobody knows how many. They've lost count.
Every time you think you've got a count on them, it's like, no, there's another one. It's like, no, I thought I counted him twice.
They must be so annoyed.
His energy and beauty into them.
Yeah.
So that they just end up being like, what? He's older now and is. And you know, Alexander. I'm a heterosexual man, but I'll say it. Alexander Skarsgård is a god.
He is, in fairness.
He was almost Thor.
How wonderful is that moment where Stellan Skarsgård first seems to appear in the film and you're like, what the hell happened? There's a genuine moment where I was like, what's the last film I saw him in? Is there enough time for this to have actually happened?
No, I was waiting for the plot twist involving the character. The character incident that would explain how we got to this
He's
point.
He's had his heart broken.
This is one of the best performances, I say this as a huge Colin Firth fan, that I have seen from Colin Firth.
Well, Colin Firth has so much fun.
I think he's seen how much adoration Pierce Brosnan got since the last one. He was like, you know what? I'm doing that. I'm going to dance all over the place and not give a shit.
The whole line is just like, well, I only told Bill, and then I told everyone.
He is really terrific. He's embraced that role. And he's actually said in interviews for years that Mamma Mia is his favorite film he's done because he had such a good time on it. And it looks, that's exactly what it looks like. It looks like everybody is having the best time.
Yeah, well, I mean, Pierce Brosnan is having his best time.
Pierce Brosnan, who is not acting in that film. The camera repeatedly comes towards him and he's just laughing. And he's not hugging a character, he's hugging Colin Firth. Like, we're back on an island! Here's some wine!
That's a great shot in the closing scene with him in the pint. Where he's in the pint in a jumpsuit. And
full belly, does not care, shirt down further than it
is. He may not be Amanda Seyfried's dad, but he's 100% all your dad.
Do we have an idea who the real dad probably
There are 33% chance of either of them.
Oh, no, I get it, but like, does anyone want to make a guess?
No, because it doesn't matter.
I'd
like to think Colin Firth.
It doesn't matter at all.
I like that it doesn't matter.
On a serious note, both films are very much tied into this idea of creating your own family. And even in the second one, where they very much come back to this idea of creating a nuclear family. It's absolutely wider than that, and looking into this thing and being able to have many different friends, many different
and
sexual partners,
dads.
Having broad families. Yeah. Exactly.
I had a weird meta moment when I was watching it, and Colin Firth's character, Harry, isn't it?
He's
at the board meeting, and I just felt really weird because in the background is Japan, and there's a giant Boruto poster. And for anyone who knows the anime Naruto, that's Naruto's son. And it's just it's his son now. And it's like, that's how old I am. Is that Naruto is no longer the main character? His son is. It's like, wow. It's a weird meta
when
moment.
When you're charting
like
your age through the background of Colin Firth appearances. All right. Shall we move on to talking about what's coming out this week?
I think we must.
Because other films do come out, though Mamma Mia is
there's
the only
one film that
Mamma Mia
is
going to come out again.
Yeah. Maybe they're re-releasing Mamma Mia.
Sing-along version is coming.
Yeah. Hey, they re-released Greatest Showman, didn't they?
I'm all over the sing-along version. Again, like Jay's Cinema of Experience, will go ahead in my Crypt Keeper role.
This really sounds like it's like a torture thing you guys are like prepping for.
This is the one part that he'll enjoy, in fairness. This is his day off.
He will savor this. This will be the experience. So, new releases this week. The Eyes of Orson Welles, directed and written by Mark Cousins, the documentary looking at Orson Welles. We talked a little bit on the podcast a couple of weeks ago about the IFI's Orson Welles season.
I caught City Lights at it this week, which absolutely terrific. Great to see with a crowd.
Was Citizen Kane there? I imagine it was.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It's
a bit
silly
on three Wells films.
Yeah, Citizen Kane, Magnificent Ambersons, Touch of Evil, all of which have yet to screen. They're on over the weekend next week, I think. I'm really, really looking forward to this. And Mark Cousins is coming to do a Q&A with Donald Clark
after it on, I think, next Thursday. Should be good. His documentaries are always really perceptive. Mm. And the trailer is now screening in the IFI. It really looked great.
And again, Orson Welles fans have a bit of a treat coming as well later in the year. I think The Other Side of the Wind is scheduled to release on the 2nd of November on Netflix.
Oh, I didn't know how to get into it. Great.
Yeah, which is pretty great. Also out this week is The Festival, starring Jermaine Clementine and Emma Rigby, directed by Ian Morris.
Oh, Jermaine's in that?
Yeah. It's after graduating from university, Nick and his uni friends go on a tour of festivals around the country. Yeah. I know nothing about this.
Yeah, me neither. It's when you said Jermaine Clement, I was like, I like Jermaine.
From the people behind The Inbetweeners, I believe.
Yeah, I think so.
Oh,
yeah.
I've actually heard decent things about this then, if this is the one I think it is.
Yeah, no, it seems to be getting
pretty
decent.
Because I remember quite liking The Inbetweeners too, of all things. Which is a film.
It's a sequel?
I'm not sure if I saw two.
It's the one where they go to Ibiza.
I thought it was the first one.
Okay, maybe that's the first one. But I remember thinking, this is something I should hate. Mm. But I'm actually quite enjoying it. Mm. Also opening this week, we talked about already, but Christopher Robin.
Oh.
Destroying your childhood, one memory at a time.
No, it's
Graham
a good
poo-pooed
film.
It.
I did enjoy it, but it's just...
Was it unbearable, Graham?
I kind of wished it to hibernate
did
a little bit
afterwards. Did
it make
your heart 100 acre?
How's that one work?
Make your heart
ache. Right, okay.
I still get
you know what? It was not
the
as sweet...
The 100 acre what?
You know...
As not part of my childhood.
It was not sweet like honey.
I know.
Come on, I had one just
I
there.
Have some... It was very good, Grant.
Thank you.
I have some Blu-rays, Rowan.
I'm way too far out of childhood to go back.
Never watched.
When it was not part of my childhood. Oh. I don't know why. I mean, speak to my parents.
Maybe they subjected me to...
I'm not sure what that was, will you? Never factored in.
I don't remember
the precise day where I said to another kid, what's that? But it must have happened.
Did you have like a Paddington poo war?
No. Barney, I guess.
Oh. I mean, I can't feel old.
I mean, like, Darren, did you see Pooh? Did you see what?
No, I didn't see Christopher Robin.
No?
It's
okay. It's okay. It's just, as I said, it mires itself way too much in the dirt of reality.
now imagine the grim and gritty Winnie the Pooh in the dirt.
And there is a thing.
One day,
when you see
you're eating honey out of hives. The next day, your face is down in the dirt.
You see 100 Acre Wood, and it's just like, that's literally just someone's garden. That's not magical. That's just a goddamn garden.
It's a literal 100 Acre Wood, the one that inspired.
Grand, but it's... Listen, also... Be more fun. Also, what I find really funny, what I find really funny about it is, there's like... These are real. Like, it's not like... Because they show up in the real world.
Yeah.
And it's like, they're real. Which means, how powerful is Christopher Robin that he's able to have created an actual other universe where he could... travel off to? I mean, I'm asking questions that the film doesn't want me to ask.
I think it's okay that
like,
the film
it's like
doesn't
a TARDIS.
I feel like it's okay the film doesn't address what happens if Christopher Robin leads an army of stuffed animals to take back
I mean,
the
just,
world.
It's just, it's really weird, and it could have been a lot better. Like, at times I did start to go, oh, this is so emotional, but then it's just like, it wasn't enough. Like, and it brings me back to Mamma Mia 2, which was like surprisingly emotional at times.
Yeah.
I was like, holy crap. And then like my mom and sister went and of course were in hysterics.
I've been ringing my mother and sisters regularly to say go to see this. I want to talk to you
about
this. My mother still hasn't been
film
audience. One of my sisters has been, and I didn't talk to her, but I talked to my mother about this, but my mother said she said it was too sad.
What?
Oh, wait,
here we
so
go again.
I think she was expecting pure joy, and then there's a little bit of sad, and you're like, oh no, the world isn't perfect.
I suppose that is one pretty big chunk of sadness, to be fair.
Particularly
when you go off the fact that this is a Meryl Streep franchise.
Also, the trailers do not show it.
Which is a good choice.
They actively try to
hide it. Which is a good choice.
It is a very good choice, because then when you get to certain things in the end,
also
you can understand why Jake Coyle is blubbing.
Also, you wonder, the cynic in me just goes... Yeah, we don't want the audience to know that Meryl Streep is not really in this film. Because Meryl Streep will likely be the thing that draws a lot of the audience back.
But I, again, as somebody who thinks that the Streep-shaped absence is a problem with the film, I understand it. No, I do. I like Lily James.
I think...
I like, you know, and Amanda Seyfried's great, but...
fair against expectations, but I really do think... I went and I love Streep in the first one. I think Lily James does such an incredible
job. She does a great
job with it.
She's so
charming. She really takes it and she runs through it. And it's... I expected once I realized that it was going to be as divided as it is, I thought there would be a lot more sort of modern day stuff.
Yeah, me too.
Once I got into it, I was like, actually, I'm happy to stay here. I'm not looking for Pierce Brosnan anymore because I'm loving Lily James so much.
I did find it funny. It was like, there was no flashback, like, this is how your mother, and I was like, you know, that would segue into the flashbacks. Yeah. So like, flashbacks would literally just happen. I was like, so is there like a door? And we're literally just walking through it from scene to scene, and that's how the
it's really well directed.
And the way it's cut, I think in the second song number is like,
oh, the one between the, where they're ringing from New York and
and
the
island. That like Woody Allen Manhattan style shot where you've got a set where they're literally either side of a wall.
And it's sort of panning through and up and around. It is actually directed. And it's directed very well.
Not just directed, not just directed.
That gives us a little step up.
Donnie Cooper's not giving a lot to do in that film.
He's not, which is good because he's a terrible actor. I'm sorry.
He is not. Watch Preacher. Dominic, he's great in Preacher.
No, he's terrible at so many things.
Finally out this week, it's The Equalizer 2, which is sadly not called The Sequelizer, but does ask the important question, what if Denzel Washington were both the old man and the sea?
I love this.
It's that line, incredibly it's incredibly dull, ponderous, self-important.
Also,
film.
Just like the first one.
I liked the first one. The first first one was just classy enough to sort of veneer up the Death Wish sort of aspect of it. This is at once wanting to play up the Death Wish aspect, but also ashamed of the Death Wish aspect. So it goes on this, it takes this urban vigilante and sends him on an international mission to investigate a murder involving the CIA in Belgium. And there's a point where at one stage in the movie he's commuting between helping inner city youths in, I think it's Baltimore where the film is set, and solving a mystery in Brussels.
It's amazing when you have the time to do it.
To do these, retirement is fantastic.
I wish I could multitask.
Retirement is amazing as far as this film is
concerned.
Well,
you know what happens if you stop when you retire?
It's like a shark, yeah. Denzel Washington is the Meg. But again, it opens with Denzel Washington on the Orient Express to give you a weird sense of like how tonally awkward and all over the place this movie is. And it's a shame because...
Does he have a mustache?
He has a beard. There are moments where it looks like it might almost cohere into something either like fun and pulpy and trashy, but enjoyable for that, or something where Washington is actually given material he can use to build a functioning character, but it never does either. There's this recurring motif that happens at the film where the radio plays this idea of a storm sweeping across the eastern seaboard of the United States. And the film is very consciously like, it's a metaphor for this like profound force of nature represented by the character played by Denzel Washington, in case you don't get that. But there's a moment where the character says, it's coming in slow and steady. And you're like, dude, we're at an hour and 40 minutes in a 2 hour and 10 minute film. The
slow and steady train pass.
The storm had better get here pretty quickly. It does have a nice climax, but absolutely not worth the time it takes to get there, unfortunately.
Yeah. To point out how much I didn't want to see this film, I could have seen this film for free, and I chose not to. I stayed in and was happier for it.
Negative money. I did not
like the first one at all. It was basically Denzel deciding, hey, you know what, I must be done with any kind of like prestige films, so I'm going to like kind of copy Liam, because we've probably have the same drinking circles, and you know, see what happens. And oh look, if I do a reasonable enough speech in between the film, in between the brutal killings, which aren't that brutal. I mean, like, the whole stopwatch thing on his watch, he's like, that is a gimmick, and it is the worst kind of gimmick. It's like, it's just so boring. And it's like, it was wasted as well in the last film, when we had Chloe Grace Moretz, who I think is a really great up-and-coming star, even though she's been in the business for a while. She's still, I think, still growing. Like, I recently saw her in The Miseducation of Cameron Post, which is amazing. She was barely in the first one, and it was totally misused use of an actor. And this, do we have anyone that works with him? Do we have, apart from Pedro Pascal, I think, is in this?
Melissa Leo is in it as well.
Who's that?
Okay. Melissa Leo
No, I'm literally asking. I'm not being...
She's an actor. She's sort of had a moment or a resurgence recently.
So, it's another Denzel Washington train.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, no, it undoubtedly is.
Does he have a speech in it?
He has several speeches
in it. Of course he does.
And I mean, but the thing is, it's just, if you thought the first one was boring, this one will put you to sleep. I quite like the first one. This is just not a good movie. And again, the premise is so good. What if Denzel Washington were the old man and the sea?
You feel like that was an elevator pitch? Yeah, it's a great pitch. So you wonder, is that the pitch? And no, I'm like, it didn't work.
Because there's literally a moment at the climax where he becomes the sea. Like, ooh, where the storm that's sweeping across the eastern seaboard hits, and it's like, ah! Now, if you could have done that without taking an hour and 40 minutes, maybe I'd be more charitable towards you. But
how long is the film altogether?
I think it's about 2 hours and 10, if not 2 hours and 20.
That should have been an hour and a half.
All right, so anyway, with that in mind, then we'll wrap up.
They're the kind of limited release that's so limited as possibly only on one screen in the country, but there are three other things out.
Oh, cool.
Sorry.
No, go for it. Sorry about that.
I'm high.
He's gone rogue.
This is your new host. Yeah. The Heiress is a Paraguayan drama that I caught recently at Galway Film Fair, was it? No, it was Gaze a couple of weeks back. It's the story of two older lesbians, one of which is put in prison. The other has to cope with life without her while selling their house. It's really slow, really quiet, and by the end, very impactful. You get to the end and you realize that everything you've seen has, you know, added up to this pretty amazing emotional punch. It's the kind of thing that I thought for a while, I don't know if I'm really with this, and then at the end was like, oh, whoa, this has been doing things.
It's amazing how films do that.
Yeah, and it does that so very, very well. Two absolutely staggering performances.
Can do that, I think.
Yeah, it's great when it happens. Mm. It's the kind of thing you sit through the credits, you're like, whoa.
Does it save it? Like you said, the film was a bit, you know, weren't sure.
No, it's not that I wasn't enjoying it. I just thought this is very slow. You know, I'm not. It's going to need to build up to a lot to justify this, and boy, it does.
So the storm comes in slow and steady, is what you're saying.
It's that kind of thing where you realize those two films. The quiet moments of drama in life are, you know, extremely high drama times. It's really, really good. The Guardians is also out, directed by Xavier Beauvoir, who did Of Gods and Men a few years ago, a French film about monks. Being slowly kind of hemmed in by Islamic terrorists. That was a fantastic film, my favorite film of 2011, I think it came out. His new one isn't so good. It's adapted from what I suspect is a very, very bulky novel, and it seems like he's trying to crow a lot in there. It's about 2.5 hours long. It's about the women left behind in France during the First World War. It's got some really great performances and a lot of social drama about, you know, gender roles, everything. Very well delivered, but it feels like it's trying to crow in way too much plot. Very affecting at times, though. Impressed by that. And to bring us full circle, there is a re-release of film noir classic Mildred Pierce.
Hint, Graham.
Listen, I'm going to go see 2001.
Excellent.
Excellent.
Okay, yeah. Cool. Let's expect a report next week.
Yeah, it's been a while since I've been in the IFI, and I don't think I've ever seen a 70mm film. Because what was it? It was Dunkirk was 35.
Dunkirk, they did in 70. They had it in 35 originally.
They did 70 at the IFI and 35 in the Lighthouse, I thought, wasn't it?
Yeah, when I went with you and Phil and that, it was 35, wasn't it?
Thought that might have been 70. I'm not
sure. Oh, okay. If it was 70, then
I think the IFI originally released it in 35 and then got a 70 print
a
couple
weeks
later.
Yeah, I think it was 35 then. It was 35 then, which was lovely.
Mildred Pierce is fantastic. You know, this one of the big concerns of film noir is the idea of men going off, the same with The Guardians, men going off to war, the women left behind. What do we do with the society? What are the men going to do when they get back? They've been displaced. How is society going to readjust to this? And Mildred Pierce inverts that in really interesting ways by saying, what about the women? They don't want the men coming back. Or, you know, it's got this real tension about working women and whether men are okay with that. Yeah, I think so. And
like,
this
what would that have been released in?
Mildred Pierce is 45, I think.
Yeah, Jesus.
Directed by Michael Curtiz just a couple of years after Casablanca. Mildred Pierce is fantastic. Joan Crawford gives an incredible performance.
I believe it was one of the first UK releases in the Criterion line.
Ah, okay.
That is how I have it.
Deserving choice.
Yeah, so I can loan it to you if you want, Graham.
That's lovely, thank you.
All right, then. With that in mind, we'll sort of wrap up. But if people want a bit more Ronan, a bit more Graham in their lives, where can they find you guys?
Get me on the Twitter machine, at Baron Ronan.
And I'm at Get Graham Geek Era on Twitter as well. Do you want me to list out all the other ones? Do we have time?
Go for it quickly.
Okay, great.
Lightning round.
Okay, right. I'm at GameAir.com. It's my gaming website. Speaking Geek is my podcast. I'm on Scanon.com. I do several reviews on that. I think they're in the hundreds now. And that's it. Oh my god, that's it. Oh, and I'm at movies.ie.
And in case listeners couldn't hear it, but Graham had checked his watch sort of Denzel Washington style while doing that. It was very impressive and shot in slow motion.
Oh.
Graham is also, too modest to say, guesting on the 250 this weekend, discussing Mission Impossible Fallout. Mm-hmm. That'll be out this Saturday. And you can follow me at Darren_Mooney at Twitter.
And do, because we all need those followers after that purge.
Cheers, guys.
What?
Twitter purged a load of bots, so my followers dropped by like 20.
Damn,
what happened?
Damn those bots with their really fine European cinema taste.
Mine didn't drop at all.
Graham is the most authentic of
us. I just don't like them. Like, when I see them and I go, nope.
Good idea.
Even if it is a slight ego boost, it's like, no.
All right, on that note, take care, guys. Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.